Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, it's being reported by some outlets that the EU is preparing to offer Theresa May a two-month delay to Brexit on the condition that MPs approve a withdrawal agreement next week, according to a draft of summit conclusion seen by the Financial Times. Darla Grybauskaitė, the Lithuanian president, has told CNN that EU leaders have agreed in principle to grant an extension to the Brexit process, but have not finalized the length of the extension. Well, what's going on in Brussels? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He is the co-host of Sputnik's Loud and Clear and is in Brussels and joins me to discuss the goings on at the EU summit, Brian Becker. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you. Wilmer, great to be here.
So, is it a two-month extension, a time yet to be determined, or something else? As I am reading, Mrs. May has requested a three-month extension. I think she made that request yesterday.
Yeah, if you really bore down on this, what seems to be happening here at this EU summit is it's actually a one-week extension because that's the amount of years that Theresa May will have to convince the House of Commons they should vote for something, not simply against something. There's been numerous votes where a majority has said no, but there's not one time in yet that a majority has said yes to a particular plan. She has a plan. It's a 538-page plan. It's got all kinds of sort of details and arcane details, but some other very vital and very divisive big picture issues. So far, the Labour Party has voted no, and a big bulk of the Conservative Party, people more conservative, more committed to Brexit than she, and a 10-person parliamentary group from what's called the DUP, which is a Protestant-based, nationalist, Ulster-based Protestant group in Northern Ireland, which is also voting no. So unless Theresa May can convince the naysayers to vote yes, unless she can do that within the next week, it appears that means that Brexit will happen without a deal.
How much of this, in your opinion, is driven by economics versus how much of this is being driven by a sense of nationalism?
Well, when you say this, you mean the people who are for Brexit.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's the pro-Brexit vote, which was an unexpected vote back in June 2016. The people who were voting no to staying in the EU were basically putting their middle finger up and pointing it towards the people they considered to be the political elites in London. It's somewhat reminiscent of Donald Trump's Electoral College victory in 2016. And it was a very close election for the referendum. 52% voted to leave the EU, 47%+ voted to stay in. The country was very divided. But the industrial heartland in London, which has been hollowed out, much the same way that the industrial Midwest and Northeast has been hollowed out over three decades of globalization, they're the folks who put their middle finger up and said, no, we don't like the current system. It might be working for those of you who like to take vacations or relocate to the Riviera or to here to Brussels or wherever, but we don't travel because we don't have the money to travel. All we've seen in the last three decades is our jobs disappear. So that doesn't mean that the leaving the EU is actually going to solve those problems, but that's why they voted the way they did.
All we've seen is our jobs disappear. Immigrants are coming into our country and taking over our lives. Xenophobia is the mindset of the day. To your point, that sounds very, very similar, not only to what they're talking about in terms of the industrialized portions of London, but it's also what's happening in the Midwest. And it seems very interesting here, at least, that folks to a great degree are still, because the driving element in the narrative is immigration, their voting, their xenophobia, and their racism against their what is really their best interest. Is that the same thing here?
Well, you know, what's happened here is the United Kingdom is a multiracial society because the British colonies in the Caribbean, who are mainly black people, have a long-standing legacy inside Britain. The Pakistani and Indian populations, because India, too, was a colony, or the Indian subcontinent was a colony of Britain. Many, many people from South Asia have long-standing roots inside the UK. The immigrants that they're talking about who have become more of a bone of contention are people coming from Poland and Romania and the other countries of Eastern Europe, because all EU countries provide their citizens the right to relocate to any other EU country. So you have many East Europeans have migrated in the last 15 years and 20 years to the UK. They're working janitorial jobs, they're working service jobs, they're working at lower wages. And at the same time, the industrial heartland of England was hollowed out. So right-wing political parties were going back to these communities and saying, look, the reason we're suffering is we've lost control of our own country, our own borders. We have people coming from Eastern Europe who are working for less. We have to regain control of the UK. We can make the UK great again. And the way we can do that is by getting rid of the burden of what's required of all EU members, which is to open their doors to other members or other citizens of other EU countries. So you had right-wing populists arguing for that. There was a left-wing element in the Brexit. It's called Lexit, left-wingers who are for leaving the EU. And that included people who were traditionally Euroskeptics. Jeremy Corbyn would have been one of them. They were against the EU, not because they were against integration. In fact, they would have been the same people who would have probably embraced Karl Marx's slogan, workers of the world unite, meaning workers, especially in Europe, shouldn't be killing each other. They should be uniting against a common enemy. But they disagreed with the EU because it's an integration project based on the needs of capital, based on the needs of the biggest, strongest banks. And it required all the working class populations of all the countries, but especially Southern Europe, the periphery of Europe, but even the industrial heartland of the UK, to sort of participate in a race to the bottom to see who could make their places more attractive to capital. And so the left wing also opposed entrance or maintaining a relationship inside the EU, but they were a minority. The dominant wing of the Leave campaign were the right-wing anti-immigrant forces.
So with the discussion now about the possibility of just a one-week extension, and Theresa May has to go back to Parliament and she has to try to put another vote in front of the MPs, the Speaker of Britain's House of Commons, John Bercow, has said that you're not going to put another vote on the floor unless it is substantially different than the other two that you have put forth and have failed. So is it possible for Theresa May, coming back from Brussels, to sweeten the pot so that both the MPs that have voted against her plan will be swayed the other way and the folks in Brussels can see that Britain is actually moving in the right direction?
I don't think so. I don't think she can sweeten the pot. I don't think the EU is making it quite clear that they're giving her a one-week extension to be able to pass a resolution in the House of Commons. But they're not offering any other concessions. There's no other deal on the table. So now the Speaker of the Parliament could say, well, as I told you last week, this is not significantly or meaningfully different than the resolution that failed earlier, and thus it won't even be allowed to come back before the Parliament. You know, if he does that, Wilmer, now he's going to be held responsible for not allowing the possibility of a solution. That's a lot of pressure for an individual to take. He himself is a former conservative Tory who has sort of, you know, turned a leaf and has come out against Brexit. He's really against Brexit. And I don't know if he, under these circumstances, will prohibit a resolution to come. If a resolution comes before the floor and it doesn't pass, that's Theresa May's problem.
Exactly.
If it doesn't even get to come before the floor, that's his problem.
Right.
And the consequences are very heavy. I want to mention one other thing, and I think this is critically important. In the last hours, more than a million people in the UK have signed a parliamentary petition on the parliamentary website calling for the end of Brexit. In other words, either to have a revocation of Article 50, which set in motion the divorce 2 years ago, or to have another referendum. And what we're hearing here in Brussels is that there may be large-scale protests in the UK this weekend demanding just that. So right now, masses of people have been basically spectators watching this weirdness play itself out in Parliament. Again, lots of majorities, but all of them for no. There is no majority for a yes. For a resolution to go forward, for an exit plan. So it's going to be, I think we're entering what could be a very unstable, well, it is going to be unstable. You have Theresa May maybe not being able to do what the EU is insisting is her last chance. We have at least a million people have signed a petition in the last few hours saying, hey, guess what? We actually don't want to leave the European Union. You have the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is here in Brussels, and he arrived yesterday, the day before Theresa May, and he has come out now with a commitment to what is basically a long-term permanent customs union, which is really not staying in the EU, but not completely breaking up from the EU. In other words, that's soft Brexit. So there's a lot of factors at play, and it's very dynamic right now.
So how does that plan impact the Irish backstop? How does the soft Brexit, what does that do as it relates to the Irish backstop? Because as I understand it, that's been a real sticking point in these negotiations, whether or not there's going to be a border.
I don't know with certainty, let me say that. And there's a lot of lots of different variants about how this could play out. But that could be it seems to me that could be at least a long-term temporary solution to the Irish issue. Because if the EU and the UK have a permanent customs union, that means it's basically like a free trade zone, right? There's not going to be tariffs. There's not the free movement of people as there were before, but there would be the free movement of goods and services. That would mean that there wouldn't need to be a hard border separating the six counties in the north of Ireland that are dominated by the Ulster Protestant minority, who are basically an appendage of British colonialism, with the rest of the Republic of Ireland. If there's a hard border, if there's not a customs union, that means that part of Ireland, on the island of Ireland, between the six counties of the north that are part of the UK and the rest of the Republic of Ireland, that's not only the border between the north and south of Ireland, it's the border between between the UK and the EU. And if that's the border that means there will be a real border. There will be customs checkpoints and so on and so forth. To Irish nationalists, that means, okay, you're dividing our country once again. And when we thought we had a de facto basic unity of the island of Ireland, which is their real goal. And if there's a hard border, I believe there will be an armed struggle again in Ireland by Irish nationalists who will say that that's unacceptable, and that means the Good Friday Agreement that ended the Irish Civil War will be basically null and void. So a customs union, a permanent customs union, allows for that border to remain basically a porous border, not a hard border.
And that takes us right back to the Troubles, then, doesn't it?
The so-called Troubles, which is a kind of a funny euphemism when you're talking about war, but yes, it does. It takes us, if there's a hard border in Ireland, I mean, Ireland should be one. It should be a united, independent, free Ireland. I mean, the six counties of the north are really nothing but, you know, it's the way that the British dealt with Hong Kong in China. They seized it, they took it, they held it, and finally the Chinese took it back. That's what needs to happen to the six counties in the north of Ireland. But that said, since that's not on the table at the moment, there needs to at least be the maintenance of the Good Friday Agreement, which is a soft border, not really a border, between those six counties and the rest of Ireland. That happens with a customs union.
But isn't the issue with Ireland a very clear line of demarcation from a religious perspective, Catholics versus Protestants, as opposed to what happened with Britain and Hong Kong?
No.
No?
No. The Catholic-Protestant thing is simply that it's giving religious coloration to what is basically an anti-colonial struggle. It's kind of the same that we might think of it with Israel and Palestine. It's not a struggle between Muslims and Jews. You know, Zionism was an extension of British colonialism, then morphed into its own sort of colonial aspirations. It's not really a religious struggle. It's a struggle between self-determination and colonialism. The same with Northern Ireland. The Protestant minority has been given these six counties. And it's not exclusively Protestant by any stretch of the imagination. Large numbers of Catholics live there. But it was really just an extension of the British Empire following the negotiated end of the British colonial domination over all of Ireland.
So to wrap this up, is there one more day of this summit? And what does Theresa May take back to Parliament?
She lives for another day. I mean, she gets a shot one more week to be able, and again, we don't know because things are so rapidly developing here. By the time this day is over, what we're talking about could also be undone. I mean, the French have made it clear that they've had it with the British indecisiveness and that unless this is solved in the next days, Britain is out of the EU, they're not going to extend it, and they're out with no deal. So we don't know, but what it appears is that Theresa May lives for another day, or to put it be more literally, maybe another week. Can she force the Tories? One, can she get the vote to the floor? And two, can she convince the Tories, who are recalcitrant Brexiteers in the Northern Ireland DUP party, if she can tell them, look, you either vote for this resolution now, or one, there's not going to be a Brexit with a deal, and my government will fall, and there will be a general election, and then you're going to have Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, and all of your perks and privileges are going to disappear real fast. So you might not like my plan, but without my plan, you're doomed. That's her basic message to her recalcitrant allies who have not been functioning as allies.
All righty. Well, I'd call that some very, very serious, serious analysis. Brian Becker, on the ground in Brussels at the EU summit. Man, as always, thanks so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Great, great pleasure to be with you, Wilmer.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Supreme Court examination of jury discrimination prompts rare question from Clarence Thomas. The Supreme Court seemed deeply troubled yesterday about the actions of a Mississippi prosecutor, Doug Evans, who has tried an African-American man 6 times for a quadruple murder and has blocked the vast majority of black potential jurors. Also, the hour-long argument yesterday brought a surprise, a question from Justice Clarence Thomas. Do wonders never cease? Let me quickly lay out the facts as I understand them. Early one hot July morning in Winona, Mississippi in 1996, 4 people were executed in Tardy Furniture Store. Months later, Curtis Flowers, who had no criminal record but had very briefly worked at the store that summer, was arrested and charged. Mr. Flowers was tried in 1997, 1999, also in 2004, 2007, 2008, and most recently in 2010. 6 times, District Attorney Doug Evans, who is white, has attempted to convict Flowers, who is black, in a prosecutorial pursuit that may be without parallel. 2 trials, as it happens, the only ones with more than one African-American juror, resulted in hung juries. 3 convictions were overturned by the Mississippi Supreme Court for prosecutorial misconduct and improper maneuvering by Evans to keep blacks off the jury. But the 2010 conviction was allowed to stand and Flowers was sentenced to death. The case is now before the Supreme Court. What is the significance of this case and Justice Thomas's question? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is the Executive Vice President of Odyssey Media, and she is Senior Adjunct Professor at George Washington's School of Law, Kim Keenan. Kim, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hi, it's great to be back.
Thank you so much for joining us on such short notice.
Yeah, I feel like I was just here.
It seems like you were just here. So, your thoughts, first of all, on what I'll call the machinations of Mississippi prosecutor Doug Evans.
Well, first, we have to remember that this is Mississippi. Okay, let's just say that again. Let's take it in. This is Mississippi. And, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. And I think this case shows what we learn everywhere, every day. If at first you don't succeed, try the case again. And that's what he did here. And, you know, this is the thing. If you try a case, every trial lawyer in the world will tell you this. On any day, in any place, you could win once and lose every other time. So, you know, for him to prosecute someone to put their life in jeopardy 6 times, I'm actually happy to see that the justices were troubled by this, because it's troubling, and that it has to be this bad of a case for them to be troubled just shows you how bad everything is going. And, you know, this once-in-a-lifetime comment from Justice Thomas, and of course, is his comment to comment on the fact that we're trying somebody 6 times? You know, the truth is, when the jury was hung, they could have let this go. They clearly didn't have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's clear that if there were no diversity on the jury, that he would have been convicted no matter what the prosecutor did, even if it was not appropriate. So once again, Clarence Thomas has proved that color is no indication of your cultural outlook and your cultural leanings. I mean, for him to ask a single question and have that be to point out that defense counsel had some white jurors struck is, you know, like a distinction without a difference. You're in Mississippi. Most of the jurors were going to be white. And if the prosecutor was striking all the black people, they didn't have anybody left to strike. And there's so little diversity that there probably weren't any other colored people available.
So the point of contention here was that the white prosecutor removed just about all of the eligible black jurors from the jury pool. So Thomas asked about the race of the jurors dismissed by defense lawyers.
Exactly.
And so he's trying to say, well, you're over here complaining about the prosecution doing it, but the defense did it too.
The black person's lawyer did it too. That's exactly what that point was for.
Excuse me, Justice Thomas, and thank you for waking up. But by the time the defense gets to their strikes, there aren't any more black people to remove. So
it's Mississippi. There probably weren't that many black people to remove. So once all the black people are gone, you strike people all the time. And I have to tell you, you don't really get to know a lot about people before you strike them. But, you know, let's face it, they're in Mississippi. It's a different place.
Yes.
I've been there many times. You know, it's different. I'm sure it's not what it was when people were marching, but I can tell you that, you know, the vestiges of it, you know,
live
are
long.
Still there.
They run
they
long,
live
and
long
they
long, and they're generational. You know, people pass down how they see the world. And for someone, I mean, just the fact pattern is a little scary. I mean, here's somebody who has no criminal record ever, and you're saying that after working very briefly at the store for a short period during summer, he changed his whole law-abiding life and became a mass murderer. I mean, isn't that a big jump? I mean, for me, that would be a big jump for anybody of any color.
And there was no physical evidence.
And there's no physical, I mean, you know, if you're a novice, think about it this way. You're a first-time criminal, and you decide to commit a public mass murder. I'm thinking, now, maybe it's a special person, but you're going to make some mistake. You're going to leave something. I'm sure there's a camera, you know, in the furniture store. I mean, it just seems like if you've had to try him six times, and three of the times the Supreme Court of the state overturned him for misconduct, that's some pretty bad misconduct. You guys, for a judge to overturn a conviction because of prosecutorial misconduct is so in and of itself rare. That's what they should have asked, what the statistics are on that. I mean, it's like a unicorn. So, you know, this isn't like something that happens all the time. But for it to have happened from the same person three times, God, even the most conservative Republicans on, and you saw Kavanaugh, all of these guys are saying, well, you know, hey, I'm real conservative, and, you know, I'm for the team, but, you know, justice, I mean, if we care anything about justice, we know that this doesn't make any sense. And I thought it was just so revealing that, you know, one of the female justices has to tell them, yeah, yes, the defendant struck white people, because by the time they got to them, there were only white people left. But I will tell you, peremptories are not exercised. Most judges will let one person strike and then the next person strikes. Like, so you know who they struck, and then you strike, and then you go back and forth. They don't usually, they may make you give them in all at the same time, but pretty much it's done in a way where you don't, in this case, you know that he was striking all the black people, so you wouldn't have needed to strike any black people. So I do give the justice points for that, because that's true. You would know that.
Let me reiterate that there was no physical evidence. No one saw him enter or leave the store. And it was in the middle of downtown, in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
The testimony used against him came from a string of witnesses who say they saw him at various points along a long walk across town before and after the shootings. And then we have what we always know, the jailhouse informants, who over the years said that Flowers confessed to them, but all three have now recanted those statements.
Wow. Well, they had to make him up. He wasn't in, I don't get it. He was in jail because they kept arresting him for this murder they couldn't prove. And they put him in with people who were known to want to say good things to make their time a little easier. I mean, my God, it sounds like one of these television shows. It doesn't sound good. It doesn't definitely give you that beyond a reasonable doubt feeling. And I mean, how you can be, you know, black people are the only people I know who can be across town and in town at the same time and be able to commit a crime and then just sort of walk around town, got free. I mean, again, you know, we don't even need to get to his guilt or innocence. You know, that's what people don't get. It's not about that, even for the purpose of this. At the end of the day, we have a system. And the reason why we have a system, and the reason why we've been able to survive despite all the inequities that exist even in the system, is because people really believe that there has to be due process. And if the prosecutor's thumb is on the scale in a way that disfavors a person of color in a situation when they most need the system to work, that person doesn't belong in the system at all. And the judges need to really, the justices need to be very forceful in their position that this is just wrong. I mean, this is just, I mean, he's already, it's like double jeopardy here.
Well,
like he's already just being tried for the same things over and over again until they get it right.
Well, no, until they get what they want.
Until they get what they want, because they can't get it right. Well, right would be to let him go and it would be over.
So. That's my point. Now, so let me ask you this, because you alluded to this a little earlier in saying that this is so heinous, this is so atrocious, my words, not yours, that even the Roberts Court, even the most conservatives of conservatives, can't find their way to stand behind this prosecutor in Mississippi. But my question to you is, does this in any way, shape, or form give you hope that even though the Roberts Court is incredibly conservative, that they can still see justice on the horizon?
Well, you know what? I really am a person from the Keep Hope Alive generation. I want to believe. Yeah, I went to law school. I went to the same kinds of law schools they went to. And I want to believe that they know the difference between right and wrong, and that there comes a time when it's not about ideology. It's about
the Constitution
that they're sworn to uphold, and the Constitution that they claim to clutch to so furiously. I mean, I think what's so ironic to me is that when Clarence Thomas was trying to become a Supreme Court justice, the first thing he said was it was a high-tech lynching.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing he said. I mean, since he's not so talkative anymore, his first words were, this is a high-tech lynching. Well, he presides over cases where we've been high-tech lynched and quite frankly, low-tech lynched. And so for him to be there asking the questions to show, right, that there was fairness in the striking of these jurors, because they were striking black people and the black person's lawyer was striking white people, I mean, white people, I mean, that's so amazingly off the mark. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's so disappointing. And, you know, again, it is a great lesson for everyone that what you look like has nothing to do with what your ideology is, or nothing to do with how you see the world, and maybe even how you see yourself, because a lot of what he does strikes me as concerning about how he even sees himself. But for this case, it is atrocious. It's absolutely atrocious. It's objectively. I think what's really bad is we live in a day and a time where it has to be this bad,
right,
before people start having to say to themselves,
this is bad.
Six times. And I mean, what does it say that you can't convince the black person that it's beyond a reasonable doubt? And I'll tell you something. I clerked for a federal judge. We did criminal. We did civil. Black people will convict you if you're guilty. Let me just say that out loud.
All the time.
People don't think that about it. But let me tell you something. I remember once being in the jury room, and the juror left a note, the jig is up. And it was a black juror and a black defendant. And I'm telling you, those people have great common sense. If you make your case, even if your case means that I'm the devil, they're going to make their case well, and then you're going to be convicted. So this whole notion that this prosecutor somehow wasn't as bad as he was the three times that he was so bad that they overcame it, on its face says that this is just raggedy and wrong on every level, and absolutely atrocious is appropriate. And, you know, we can't defend Clarence Thomas's questions or his behavior. Even when he's silent, it's offensive to all the black men and women who fought and struggled so that that opportunity would be present in our lifetimes. It is such an affront to them. And, you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, my black person on the Supreme Court is Justice Sotomayor. I mean, she shows more openness, more, you know,
understanding.
I'm in the fight to do what's right than people of any color. So, you know, like I said, I try not to get caught up in what people look like. I try to get caught up in what they do and how they think. And, you know, Justice Thomas has proved time and time again that whatever he can do to make it harder, to make it more difficult for particularly Black people to live in the society that we created that really was justice for all, he does it. So
A couple of things.
I don't put my faith in him.
You talked about Mississippi. Well, Winona, Mississippi, which is where this took place, it has quite a sordid past. Fannie Lou Hamer was beaten by the Winona police. The train station where Emmett Till arrived from Chicago is across the street from the store where this mass murder took place. The Ku Klux Klan has marched in Winona a number of times. So that, all of that to get me to this point, and we just have about 2 minutes left, this to me is another data point stressing the fact of why it's important for us to vote. Because in most counties, the jury pools are selected from the voter rolls. And if you're not on the voter rolls, you're not going to be sitting in the jury box. And if you're not sitting in the jury box, you cannot have any impact on the lives of people such as
Mr. Flowers.
Mr. Flowers, exactly. Curtis Flowers.
It is
imperative to understand that the only way that you deal with the injustices to a Curtis Flowers, you've got to be part of the process. Final point, and let me get your quick take on this. How is it that Doug Evans, the prosecutor, can still have a job?
Well, because the people he works for think like him. And because there aren't enough Black people in probably Winona, Mississippi to really stop the city and get this done. But I do think it sheds a light on there. And maybe some of our friends, our civil rights friends, need to go take a nice visit there, because people need to be reminded that they're part of the contiguous United States of America. And that while this may be your history, it cannot be your future.
And there is a reason that former President Ronald Reagan launched his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is not too far away from Winona.
Well, there you go.
Kim Keenan,
yes. As
always, thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back. Might be sooner than you think.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Really appreciate
all
it.
All right,
folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Question: who is Marty Gottsfeld? What did he do? And why is he in solitary confinement? For insight into these questions and others, we turn to my next guest. She is the wife of Marty Gottsfeld, Dana Gottsfeld. Dana, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Instead of me laying this out, tell us, please, who your husband is, what he did, and why is he now in solitary confinement?
My husband is a guy from Somerville, Massachusetts, who stood up for a wheelchair-bound girl who was locked in a psych ward against her will, where she was abused and lost functioning of her legs. He stood up for her in a way that didn't harm any patients, but made it untenable for the hospital to hold her anymore. In our last year, he was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison by Judge Nathaniel Gorton. That was the same judge who oversaw Aaron Swartz's case. And in February, he was transferred to MDC New York, which has been in the news for no heat or power during these bad blizzard storms. And they put Marty in solitary, I think because of the journalism he's been doing since he's been behind bars. He contributes to papers on both sides of the political aisle, from The Intercept to InfoWars.
So Justina Pelletier was diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, a genetic malady that leads to weakened muscles, neurological problems, and dementia. Her parents took her to Boston Children's Hospital. From there, she was taken, was it Hopkins?
Her main hospital was Tufts.
That's right. She was taken to Tufts, where Tufts said that she was not suffering from mitochondrial disease, that her issues were in her head, that she was psychosomatic. And as her parents tried to have her released from the hospital took her into custody, charged her parents with child abuse. And then this is where your husband got involved, correct?
Yes. Well, she usually went to Tufts for her, you know, world-renowned doctor. One of her doctors moved to Boston Children's Hospital, so she went there to see him for some gastrointestinal problems. And when they got there, they told her that she's not being harmed by her mitochondrial disease. She has psychosomatic disorder. She's making up the symptoms. They're in her head. Whereas she's had all this history of mitochondrial disease with her doctor at Tufts, and they decided to lock her in a psych ward, treating it as a mental condition.
And she was only 14 at the time.
Yeah, she was only 14. She's a sick girl. Her body is giving out on her. All she wants is help. When she gets there, they put her in a psych ward, and her parents were confused. She was confused. And it got weird because it wasn't following like the course of treatment. Like when you tell a doctor that something isn't working, you try and find a solution that will help. They kind of continued to steer her on a path that was making her worse and worse and going against all the conventional wisdom for how to help somebody with this condition. They were pushing something that she had never had, that the symptoms didn't lead to, this weird diagnosis called psychosomatic disorder. And we saw the effect. She lost functioning in her legs. She has a colonoscopy bag for her stomach, which wasn't being taken care of. She wasn't allowed to sleep. She wasn't getting her vitamin cocktail. So they were taking a sick girl and they were making her sicker on purpose.
So why, once she was transferred to the psychiatric ward, why were her phone calls to her parents limited? Why was she, according to, this is an article in Mint Press written by John Kiriakou, Sputnik's own John Kiriakou, why were her, she was only allowed for a 120-minute call per week with her parents. The call was monitored. During the call, they were forbidden from discussing her care.
Yeah, does this sound like a normal, like, way to treat a patient who's looking for help? Everything you said was right.
So how did Marty find out about this?
Well, we live in Boston. And it started to make the news first through social media. That was picked up by national outlets like Fox, CRTV. So it was, if you're on the beat of child abuse cases, which we were from our time fighting institutional child abuse in Utah, it would come up on your feed. You would be paying attention.
Okay.
So Marty is a senior systems engineer. Computers are his bread and butter, and her parents were coming to the media. They were making public statements that they were afraid their daughter was going to die. She was in constant pain. They weren't giving her Lyrica, you know, which numbs her, the pain in her body. So she was in constant pain, and her life was at stake. So Marty did a DDoS, a distributed denial of service, during a fundraising day.
Wait a minute. Before we get there.
Sure.
Because of the way that her communications were being monitored, she resorted to using small pieces of paper to send messages to her parents. On one, she stated, "I'm being tortured."
Yeah, she would fold them up in origami, so she could sneak them out because they were monitoring all her communications. she was terrified whenever they tried to even just speak to her about what was happening with her. DCF would get involved. I think at some point her dad wasn't even allowed to speak with her at all. Wasn't allowed to come up. This is called medical kidnap. This is way beyond what people who believe in science would ever do.
So the Boston Globe did an investigation, and they found that Children's Hospital had done this before. In the previous 18 months, the hospital had removed at least 5 other children from their parents for, quote-unquote, medical child abuse, saying something that the hospital staffers called a parentectomy.
Mm-hmm. They do it so often, they came up with a term for it.
And so now your husband sees this. He's a computer security expert, and he initiated a denial of service attack against the hospital's computer system and against the Wayside Youth and Family Support Network, where Justina was later moved. How did they find out that your husband, Marty, was the one that initiated the computer attack?
I think it started, we had a video from Anonymous that said that Boston Children's Hospital needs to let Justina go back to her family. And that's just a First Amendment free speech video that was uploaded to one of our YouTube channels, Logan River, and it's still there. That sent the FBI to us. I can say that we also went to the FBI in person by ourselves, asking them to look into child abuse. They wouldn't speak with us when we went there voluntarily, but they were more than happy to come to our house. We're advocates for children against institutional abuse. We went to all of these people. We went to all the oversight bodies, including like JCO, the Joint Commissions on Hospital Accreditation. We went through all of the normal channels you would go to protect people from institutional abuse, and they just weren't listening.
So what's going on right now with Marty? The judge in the case, I think it was yesterday, filed a writ for Marty to appear. And now you've got the Southern District of New York getting involved, seeming to try to block. There was a writ of habeas corpus. The judge commanded to have Marty brought to his court. What happened there?
Right. So just to clarify, Marty has his trial docket. That's in Massachusetts. And he also has a docket again in New York for improper solitary confinement. As soon as he got to, he was transferred to MDC Brooklyn on February 15th. They asked him if he was an activist. He said yes, and they put him in solitary without the usual remedies for, hearings or paperwork to get out of this shoe, this special housing unit. So we have an open injunction. I mean, we have an open lawsuit from when they did this at MCC New York. And he filed an injunction to get out of the shoe. The judge ordered a show cause hearing where they would have to, the defendants, the jail, and acting director Hugh Hurwitz would have to say why he should stay in the shoe. And then the judge issued an order that he wanted to see Marty in person. But today, just the latest is the U.S. Attorney's Office is defending the jail for some reason in this civil case, said that Marty is going to be transferred to a communications management unit, which is where they put terrorists and politically inconvenient people. And that since he's going to be transferred anyways, the judge shouldn't even bother giving him his day in court and just asking to set up a time sometime in the future to address this issue if it comes up again. So today the judge said that he wants the defendants to submit pro se when, ex parte, so just to the judge, when Marty will be transferred to this communications management unit. So as of now, Marty's been in the solitary confinement unit, the SHU, since February 15th for over a month now, with no release.
Why are they holding him in solitary confinement? What's their rationale?
Well, Marty writes. Marty's a journalist. He's been published at a bunch of different publications, and he exposes the Bureau of Prisons and corruption in the DOJ. Since he's been at MDC Brooklyn, he's written an article about how the Bureau of Prisons is scamming taxpayers in order to maximize the pension of the wardens. So he's not backing down. You know, when you're doing the right thing and you're exposing the right people to stand behind your work, and that's why they're sending him to this, I think, to this communications management unit in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is so crazy. They're to put him with terrorists when he didn't hurt anybody, and it's crazy.
John Kiriakou writes, the Gottesfeld experience should be a reminder for all of us. The Justice Department will stop at nothing to silence truth tellers. It doesn't want people to know about crooked judges and prosecutors, unsanitary and unhealthy conditions, animal-grade food, and the violation of constitutional rights. It doesn't matter who the president is. They all do it. We just have to keep up the fight.
Well said, John. I think more than anyone, John knows, you know, what it means to fight. It's been a real eye-opener for me personally. I can tell you that the Justice Department, the FBI, it's all so different than the propaganda that you watch on television. It's very hard to get justice. It's very hard to hold people accountable, especially when you have corruption, conflicts of interest, and other untoward behavior in the highest echelons. I think John's right. You just have to keep fighting, because sometimes you are successful. Sometimes you do win.
Does Marty deny having launched the denial of service attack?
No.
Okay. So what would the standard sentence be? What would the standard process be for someone who is involved, I will assume, for the first time, who has hacked into a system and initiated a denial of service attack? What would the standard charge be, and what would the standard sentence be?
Just a quick disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer or even a legal beagle. So
understood.
Just want to, okay. Yes, there is, maybe it's called a principle, that you're supposed to give people sentences in line with the common amount of punishment compared to people.
Sentencing guidelines.
Referring to.
Sentencing guidelines.
Yeah. Uh-huh. From my experience, people get between, from what I've seen, like 1 to 5 years. The only other person I can think of with these kinds of CFAA charges that got this much was Jeremy Hammond. His judge was married to one of the people directly impacted by the charges against him, which is just so obscene that she would not recuse herself. Just like we have Marty's judge with conflicts of interest, and you can see it bear out in the sentencing, I think. This is like way above and beyond. So we are in the process of appealing.
So in just a couple of minutes we have left, what are the two things that you want my audience to clearly understand, and how can my audience help you?
I'll start with how they can help. We have a website called Free Marty G, and this is a very big and involved operation with Marty behind bars. I do a lot of work on the outside, so we're always looking for video editors, regular editors, typists, graphics, people, any kind of people that literally can print things and send them to him, send him mail. So if you can contact freemartyg@gmail or freemartyg on Facebook or Twitter, we would love your help. And then for a final message, I'm trying to think what he would want people to know.
What do you want people to know about your husband?
What do I want people to know? My husband?
Outside of being an advocate for children, And obviously a very dedicated advocate for children.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he was greatly influenced by watching Star Trek growing up, watching Captain Picard make the right calls and hard choices. I think Marty is someone who rolls the hard six and does the right thing even when it's really hard.
Okay.
And so I think that there's a lot of space here. Unfortunately, there's too many opportunities of institutional abuse of children. So I would appreciate, you know, using attention on this case to amplify what's going on to kids in institutional abuse.
Dana Gotsfeld, thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour. And I'm glad that we've been able to use this program in the little way possible to highlight your husband Marty's case. And this is a great piece written in Mint Press News by our own John Kiriakou. Dana, thank you very
much.
Thank
you so much.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.